Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome all of you, but especially the University of Wisconsin Law School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. What class are you with? Secure transaction. That makes sense. Why are you here? Thank you for coming. You may be seated.
Can we ask them questions?
Justice Crooks wants to know if we can ask you questions. We'll refrain. I call our second case 09AP1007 BNP Paribas versus Olson's Mill Inc. Arguing on behalf of BNP Paribas is Brady Williamson. Ms. Williamson.
Chief Justice, members of the court, my name is Brady Williamson, and with Catherine Statler of Godfrey & Kahn, we're here on behalf of BNP Paribas, and this is indeed a case about secure transactions. This case is planted thick with potential issues and procedural complications, but some of them are ghosts, not worth chasing. To decide this case, this court need not depart from the undisputed facts, the statutory commands of Chapter 128, and the most basic legal principles of secured transactions. And foremost of those principles is that a court cannot compromise, cannot eliminate, cannot depreciate a secured interest without the consent of the interest holder. Now, this is what we know in this case beyond a doubt. Olson's Mills, the granary, borrowed $58 million from BNP, and that entity defaulted on the loan. BNP had a security interest in most of Olson's Mills' assets.
What about real estate?
But not real estate, Chief Justice, because Olson's Mills did not own the real estate.
What about equipment?
BNP had a second lien on the equipment, second to Bay State Bank. But a second lien is nonetheless a lien. It's a secured interest. So the liens that BNP had were perfected, filed, paramount. It included inventory, but it included a host of other assets, including equipment.
Receivable?
Pardon me?
Accounts receivable?
Yes.
What else?
Your Honor, directing the court's attention to the second record document, Exhibit D, there is a list of some dozen items on which BNP had a secured interest, just to name a few: general intangibles, inventory, investment property, and all proceeds and products thereof. It was an extensive lien. I think it is fair to say that it was a lien on virtually everything, including, and this is very important, the going concern value of the business. Goodwill, the going concern value. Now, the trial court did not value any of these assets, but we know this much. They were undoubtedly worth more than the $9 million that BNP received, and their value was far less than the total amount of the debt, $58 million of debt. BNP, in short, had a secured claim for the full value of the collateral and an unsecured claim for everything else, the deficiency. Now, here's the problem. The trial court directed the sale of these assets, free and clear of all these liens, over BNP's repeated objections. The trial court thought that what it was doing was practical, made sense, but it wasn't the court's decision to make. Eventually, not at closing, not on the sale, eventually, BNP received $9 million in payments over a period of time from the sale of grain.
So are you saying this just shouldn't have been a Chapter 128 at all because there's no way you could recover?
No, in fact, Your Honor, it was an ideal candidate for Chapter 128 because the creditors, BNP, felt that it was important to have a receiver appointed immediately, which Chapter 128 permits, unlike, I might add, Chapter 11 in the Federal Bankruptcy Code. So far from being the wrong place, it was the right place to resolve these issues.
So where did it go wrong?
I'm sorry?
So where did it go wrong?
Your Honor, I'm still sorry.
So where did it go wrong?
Well, where it went wrong, I think, is that the trial court failed to appreciate a principle that's been the law since at least, I don't want to exaggerate, Anglo-Saxon times, which is that a secured interest cannot be invalidated, compromised, depreciated, without the consent of the holder of the interest. I mean, the notion of security, Roman law had mortgages on residences, and that's continued, obviously, until now. In 1935, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Radford, laid down these basic principles that a secured interest, to use a phrase, passes through bankruptcy.
It does, Counselor, but there are cram downs in federal bankruptcy. And as I read all of this, I was trying to figure out, did the trial court cram down your client's security interest? Because that's not an option in a Chapter 128. And as I tried to figure that out, I looked for proof of what was the secured interest, not by names of assets, but what was the value that you represented to the trial court was secured. And I couldn't find it. So if you could help me with that, that would be great.
First of all, Your Honor, at the risk of being slightly irreverent, the precise value doesn't matter, because what was lacking in this instance was the consent of the holder of the secured interest. The practical answer to your question is that we know that the value of the going concern was in excess of $9 million. Why do we know that? Because the bidder, the successful bidder, as the trial court perceived it, paid in excess of $20 million. Now, it paid that in a variety of ways. But clearly, the value of the going concern was more than $9 million. The second point, Justice Rogensack, and related point, is that even if the secured portion of the debt had been satisfied, it wasn't, but even if it was, the bank received nothing on the deficiency. One of the other problems with the trial court's decision was that it placed a number of other unsecured creditors ahead of BNP. BNP received nothing on its unsecured debt, not a penny. And that violated the priority scheme that's laid out in Chapter 128.
Counselor, can you refer me to where it specifically says that you have a security interest in the going concern value of the mill?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay, if you would look at Record Document 2, which is Appendix Page 494.
Okay.
That's the easiest. It contains a list of all of the items that are subject to the security interest.
And it specifically sets out the going concern value.
It uses the term general intangible.
Well, that's fine, but that's a little different to me. Goodwill Is that what you're referring
yes,
to?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. And obviously the business had value going forward because...
I don't dispute that. I'm just trying to figure out what was your client's security interest, and was that interest not protected according to the statute's requirements? That's all I'm trying to figure out.
And Justice Rogenczak, the bedrock is the financing documents, and I've given you the citation
yeah,
today.
Right.
It's also interesting that the trial court's order, for all of its flaws, does get one thing straight. The trial court's order says, and I quote, that the $9 million payment was only in partial satisfaction of its secured claim. And that's paragraph 10C, record document 110. Now, we can spend time on any number of the procedural quirks of this case, the side trip to the federal bankruptcy court, the trial court's concepts of notice and due process, the fact that the Court of Appeals summary decision of 6 pages took 14 months to produce. But all of that really is a distraction from the basic point, and that is the trial court did what it had no authority to do.
Well, and that, Wilson, can I ask you something on that particular point? As I look at Chapter 128, it seems to envision in several places, although not as specific as I recollected, that the circuit court does have equitable powers and equitable authority. Now, there are a number of things I agree with you that seem to run counter to specific provisions of Chapter 128. But can those variances be justified on the basis of the equitable authority of the court?
No, Your Honor, because as the particularly as the justices on this court who have sat on the trial bench know, they do have great discretion, but it's discretion within rules. Let's take the preceding case where the plaintiff filed a lawsuit. And by filing the lawsuit, the plaintiff doesn't submit to the boundless discretion of the court in a personal injury case. It's cabined, it's limited by this court's decisions, by the rules of procedure, by statute. And here, of course, we have 3 decisions from this court, including the Damco case that Justice Rogenczak wrote last term and that Justice Crooks dissented in, the Wisconsin brick and block case, which goes much farther back, 1972. But in a sense, they all stand for the same proposition, which is codified in Section 128.18.4, which is a trial court cannot compromise a secured interest without the party's consent.
Well, let's suppose we agree with you on all of that, and let's suppose that there have been a number of orders here that don't fully comply with the exact language of the statute. Your position is your client didn't consent. Your position, though, is your client was in this all the time, right? And there's some indication in the Court of Appeals decision that appropriate objections weren't made at appropriate times, and that there may be waiver or forfeiture, whichever you prefer. There's some discussion in the Court of Appeals, which you object to is not correct, that it's hard to tell exactly what your client had a secured lien on. This is all very general language in the Appendix 494 as to what's secured and not secured. I don't even understand some of it, let alone be able to isolate that asset and say, hey, this is one that you've got secured. I mean, it looks like you're trying to secure everything except that which is secured by somebody else. Maybe that's a better definition of what you're trying to do. Maybe it wouldn't comply with the chapter on secured interest. But along with its equitable rights and along with its language limiting the court, how many years since this has all been sold off? How long has this property been in business? And you asked for a stay from both the Court of Appeals and us, and neither one of us gave you a stay. So this transaction has proceeded, right? The accounts receivable are still in the receiver's hands?
Yes.
Are they worth anything?
Not much, Your Honor.
All right. That's what I thought. So, and you got $9 million, right?
Yes.
Without interest?
Yes.
Okay. So how do you unscramble this egg? I mean, you have to be somewhat practical, and we might say, hey, trial court really erred in A, B, C, D, or E, right? We could say that. But what are you entitled to? I mean, you're asking in your briefs to set this back. Do you want to trace assets? Or the third thing you asked for is damages, if I remember correctly, right? So what can court really do, assuming you're absolutely right in everything, which is a big assumption, but nevertheless, right? What do you really expect to get out of this?
I suspect that few financial institutions, especially these days, are accused of altruism. But the primary reason that this court needs to correct this error is because a lender, in-state, out-of-state, needs some certainty that its security interests will be honored and protected. Because if they don't have that, they have precious little confidence in lending against a security.
Yeah, but
now, Chief, to answer your question precisely.
Before you do that, this is Court of Appeals opinion is not published, right?
Yes.
It is not published. In fact, it's an opinion and order, and I don't even know if under our present rules it would be persuasive authority. Right?
I would suggest it's not very persuasive.
Well, I mean, I'm not talking about the merits, Mr. Williamson. I'm not talking about the merits. I'm talking about the nature of this order and opinion could not be used as persuasive authority, right? So, in light of that, you may continue your answer. You want us to correct an error.
As Justice Crooks noted in his dissent in Adamanco, this law has been on the books in Wisconsin since 1937. There have been precious few appellate decisions, let alone Supreme Court decisions, construing it. Yet, for a variety of reasons, including cost of litigation, it is being more frequently used. That may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing, perhaps there are things the legislature should do. But this case provides this court with an opportunity not only to correct an error, but to help establish the law of secure transactions. Not the UCC, not the Federal Bankruptcy Code, but this particular chapter 128. Both in the first case and this case, the phrase unscrambling the eggs has been used. And it would have been a lot easier if an appellate court had heard this case sooner, but it didn't. And obviously the third-party transactions, those people who dealt in good faith with the new owners, no one's going to ask them for money back, grain back, anything like that. But the subject of the receivership still has assets. The receiver is still in place. And I think it's fair for me to note that CCAP would tell us that this case continues to be litigated in the trial court, because what is before this bench today is a final order, a sale order. But it's not as if the judge, the parties, the issues have run away, have evaporated. Clearly, the bank here knows that its alternatives, practical alternatives, are limited. It does not expect to recover $58 million less $9 or $51 million. But the fact that a remedy may require some creative thinking, might require a little bit of an unorthodox approach, does not mean, should not deter this court from correcting an error of law.
What's the remedy?
Justice Rogenczak, the remedy is a remand, and it would be for the trial court to decide whether it was more appropriate to, in effect, re-auction the assets, to require a transfer of the assets from the new owner to BNP with the new owner having the ability to ask for compensation for the amount that it's expended to preserve and enhance the assets. Granted, this is not a case where this court can say reversed and remanded with instructions. It's going to take a little bit of work. But we can't start at the end and work to the beginning. We can't say, gee, a remedy might be a little tough here. Let's try a remedy that corrects the error of law and does a better job of restoring the parties to the positions they should have been in. In other words, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. And the importance of establishing some clear law in this area just should not be underestimated.
Are you asking then for this court to set a remedy? Or are you asking that we do not address the issue of remedy if you would prevail on the other stuff, but merely remand for any and all discussion and determination of remedy to be handled in the circuit court?
Justice Bradley, certainly the latter. I think this court often gives trial courts room to fashion a remedy that's more appropriate. This business is very important to this part of the state. There's no question about it. It's a very large operation. And from a distance of 150 miles or so, I don't think that this court is the right entity to be fashioning specific remedies. But the fact is, we don't know yet the value of what's left. We don't yet know the value of what was on appendix page 454. But we do know there was value there. And it's important that that value be established.
Do we know what the receiver now has? Do we know what the receiver now has other than accounts receivable? And you shouldn't respond if it's not in the record.
I don't think it's in the record, Your Honor. Obviously, we can provide that should the court find it appropriate. There is no doubt, however, that the receivership exists, the receiver exists, and assets in the entity that was the subject of the receivership exist. Let me end, as my time is almost up, with one note from the April 9th, 2009 hearing transcript. At one point, the trial judge said that he would have adopted the receiver's recommendation to approve my client's bid. Quote, if this was a matter of strict law, close quote. Record 107 at 35. Instead, though, the court refashioned itself in the rule of law, preferring, in its own words, a locally based bidder over a distant lender.
You think this is a Homer case?
I think that the trial court took into account factors that it had no business taking into account.
What do you think is the most significant legal defect in these proceedings is? And a response that your client didn't agree is not quite enough.
The fact that, notwithstanding this court's holding in Linton, that the trial judge ignored the receiver's clear recommendation to approve the bid of my client, and within 24 hours, based on two handwritten pages of notes, accepted another bid. That would be the second most egregious.
Is the trial court judge required to accept what the receiver?
Your Honor, in the Linton case, the Supreme Court, this court, said that unless there were an egregious low bid or some kind of malfeasance, misfeasance, insider trading, to use a more modern phrase, that it had to accept the bid that was certified by the receiver. I mean, that's why we have receivers. Conduct auctions, look at the bids. In this case, there were 8 hours plus of bidding, 22 bids, and the receiver picked PNB's bid. The next day, when the parties went to court to have the court approve that recommendation, there was a new bid. Actually, there was negotiations on the record, followed by two pages of off the legal tablet of an offer, and the judge accepted that. But that offer ignored Chapter 128. It ignored the priorities. It ignored the secured loans. And the trial court, however well motivated, simply didn't have the authority to accept that. Let me end with one reference to the Adamanco case from last term. That case was about a letter of credit. And this court decided that a letter of credit was not property of the estate properly. A secured interest is not property of the estate. That's why a judge can't dispose of it.
I agree with your premise, obviously. I mean, that was the premise that underlies Adamanco. My concern is I'm having trouble finding out how much of a security interest you actually had in what was sold and how much was unsecured. And I get your argument about they should have gotten something, they didn't get anything for the unsecured. I'm not having a problem with that. I'm having a problem with figuring out what was the size of their secured interest, because I agree with you, it isn't. It's a different standard, though, than Adamanco, because the letters of credit, those dollars never were part of the estate. This property is part of the estate, but it does have a different flag on it because it's secured. And I'm trying to figure out how big the flag is, and frankly, that's where I'm having trouble.
The succinct answer is we don't know. The slightly more expansive answer is it's a lot more than $9 million because the party that was awarded the property paid a lot more than $9 million for it. And if you look, Justice Rugensack, at the catalog of items on which BNP has security, it encompasses tangibles and intangibles.
Yeah, I know. I've been looking at that. It's not the list that bothers me. It's the value of it that bothers me. And as you yourself point out, even if they were not totally secured, they didn't get anything for the unsecured claim. And that's an argument to me is separate and distinct from your argument that they couldn't sell this property because they compromised the interest of the secured creditor. Well, you only compromise it to the extent of the security, right? Won't you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, and I can't figure out the extent of the security, so that's what I'm having trouble with.
And, Justice, let me end by getting back to the Chief's invitation. The third significant error of law that was made here mm-hmm. was that in the space of 36 hours, none of these other items were valued. The speed of this proceeding may or may not have reached the standpoint of a due process violation. But the fact is, nobody had a moment to try to determine what the general intangibles were worth, what the intellectual property, if any, was worth, what even the accounts receivable at that stage were worth. And that's another error that this court can help remedy.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none, thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thomas M. Olgenisi, who is representing Olson's Mills. Justice Bradley keeps reminding me while you're doing the podium that Justice Prosser is not present and he will not be participating.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Honorable Court, my name is Thomas Olenichek. With me is Colleen Kelly. We're with the law firm of Liebman, Conley, Olenichek, and Jerry in Green Bay. We represent Olson's Mill Acquisition Company, which was a successful bidder in this matter. My learned counsel opponent, who I've known for 4 years, is correct in that there are some serious issues of law here that the court needs to decide, and I would present to you that the Circuit Court for Green Lake County fully acted within the law, fully acted within the statute, and I hope to cite to you those provisions that I think would help you understand the position. Also, I think this court has an opportunity today to put some meat on the bones of this statute, if I may, because there is a dearth of law that can help circuit courts in addressing these issues. I just want to correct something that Mr. Williamson said, because it's just an incorrect statement. The court on April 8th in Green Lake County, April 8th, 2009, held a hearing on the auction. At the end of that hearing, Olson's Mill, Inc., went to the bankruptcy court, sought an order to file a Chapter 11. It was not until a week later, on April 14th, that the actual handwritten offer was made to the court. So this wasn't a 36-hour changeover. There was a considerable period of time between these two hearings, and I would like the court to really understand that. I also want to make sure that the court has a full understanding of the nature of the business of Olson's Mill, Inc., because the nature of this business included not only the assets of Olson's Mill, Inc., which were real estate, equipment, accounts receivable and inventory, but the business also relied heavily on the assets of Olson Brothers Enterprises, LLP, Olson Brothers Leasing, and the assets of David and Paul Olson. Without the conglomerate use of all of these assets, this particular business really would have and has had difficulty in operating. I say that because Olson Brothers Enterprises owned real estate and grain bins, which were used in the storage of the assets of Olson's Mill. Almost 70 to 90% of the assets of that inventory of grain and agronomy were stored in Olson Brothers Enterprises property. Olson Brothers Leasing owned vehicles which were used in the operation of Olson's Mill. Now, in negotiating and consummating its loan transaction with OMI, BNP not only took the security interest it took in the assets of Olson's Mill, but it also took the guarantee of Olson Brothers Enterprises, LLP, and Olson Brothers personally, both Paul and David, as additional security for his loan. Now, BNP filed a suit against these other entities in order to collect on the guarantees and, in fact, has received a $50 million judgment that's been recorded in this state, and I would ask you to take judicial notice of that fact, against the Olson Brothers Enterprises assets, which have been dispersed to the Olson Brothers personally. This case is extremely complicated, and you have to understand all of the different parts of this business in order to understand why the circuit court did what it did in determining these assets. Now, this was a sale of specific assets of OMI. It wasn't the sale of OMI as a going concern. That's a critical difference I think the court needs to understand.
So it was like a bulk sale transaction rather than...
Well, it wasn't a bulk sale either. It was a specific sale. The receiver chose to withhold certain items. He withheld accounts receivable. There are other intangibles that he withheld. In fact, we haven't had an accounting by the receiver. The case is still pending. We have scheduling conferences every now and then based on what's going on here. And there's going to be some period of time before the dust settles in this case. And that is a situation in which the receiver chose, under his authority under the court order, to sell certain of the assets, not the assets and not the business as a going concern. The reason he did that is he couldn't sell the business as a going concern without the use of the other assets. And I think if you read especially the transcript from the April 8th hearing, counsel for Olson's Brothers Enterprises made it clear that they were not going to cooperate with BNP if they were the successful bidder on these assets.
Mr. Olenichek, what authority do you think the court had under Chapter 128 to not accept the recommendation of the receiver, to not accept the highest bid, to basically accept another bid that was not part of the bidding process? It strikes me as I read the sequence of events that occurred that the court ignored several provisions in Chapter 128. And my question to you is, what authority did the court have to do that?
I think it had two specific statutory authorities. One is in 128.01, which is a broad supervisory provision that says that the circuit court shall have supervision of proceedings under this chapter and may make all necessary orders and judgments therefore and all assignments for the benefit of creditors. Secondly, under 128.15 sub 2, the court is authorized to allow secured creditors to participate in the proceedings and allow for such sums only as shall be proved to be due over and above the value of the securities. And what we've got here is a situation in which the court looked at the value of the secured interest and found that the value of the security that was left by these bids was essentially the $9 million of inventory. Understand also, Justice Crooks, that in this case, BNP had a bid for these assets. They could have credit bid this up to $58 million if they chose to. When the court reopened the bidding process, and which was done fluidly throughout the week and a half that transpired from the day of the auction until the final order was entered, the court looked at all of the opportunities BNP had to credit bid its bid up to the $58 million. Why didn't it do that? I'll tell you why. Because if they would have credit bid it, they would have been limited to the amount that they could have recovered out of other assets from Olson Brothers Enterprises and the Olsons particularly. That's the nature of what we're dealing with here. It's similar to a case where in a foreclosure action, a bank may have a personal guarantee from a debtor, goes to foreclosure, bids its balance due on its note, even though the property may be worth less than that, and then tries to go after the debtor to collect on his guarantee. Well, in that case, the approval of the foreclosure sale by the circuit court limits the value of the property to what was bid, and they can't come back and ask for a deficiency at that time. The same thing happens in this case, in which if Parabaugh would have credit bid their bid up and above, they would have been limited to what they can recover on the other end of this. And that's the basic issue. The other thing that I think the circuit court really followed the rule here, and that was in the Wisconsin brick and block case. Basically, what the court said is that, as a general rule, the court has the power under Chapter 128 to sell the assigner's property free of valid liens or encumbrances if the lien holder participates in the proceedings. Well, we had full participation here. We had BNP Paribas actually file a summons and complaint and submit itself to the circuit court and allow for the circuit court to take over and appoint a receiver in this case. They were intimately involved in the bidding process. They were at every hearing. To say that somehow the court didn't give credence to BNP's cooperation and intimate involvement in this case is just not true.
If I were trying to find out how much of BNP's security interest lies against property that was sold at this sale, is there any way that I can do that?
Yes, you can look at the transcripts, Justice. And if you look at the April 8th and April 14th transcripts at pages 139 to 140 and 160 of the April 8th.
139 and 140 of, April
of
8th.
The appendix.
Okay.
That's the April 8th hearing, and pages 166 and 169 of the April 14th hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, excuse me. I'm sorry, you finished the answer.
In those cases, there's replete discussion on the record of the fact that all that BNP has here is $9 million of security. The receiver even says that. And the counsel for BNP didn't challenge that. I mean, so I got real problems in suggesting here that somehow they end up with $58 million of his security interest when the value of the assets wasn't there.
Well, that leads me to the question I was going to ask you. On page 494 of the appendix, where there's listed from 1 to 14 the collateral, I mean, everybody agrees that the collateral on inventory is clear.
Correct.
Right. What about all the others? And accounts receivable, too, because they've been held.
Okay. They have accounts receivable. They have accounts.
What are accounts?
Accounts would be accounts with customers.
Okay. Do we have that here?
Unfortunately, what we had here was about $1.5 million of bad checks that were bouncing around to the customers.
Okay. Bank accounts.
Bank accounts. The receiver took the bank accounts when the receivership was filed.
And are they secured? Does BNP have security on the bank accounts? Is that a secured transaction?
The receiver has whatever bank accounts there were, the receiver has.
Still has,
and because he's the receiver, he's holding them for the bank.
What about chattel paper?
I don't know if there was or not.
Okay, commercial tort claims.
I don't believe there were any tort claims.
Deposit accounts.
They would have been in the custody of the receiver.
Documents.
Custody of the receiver.
General intangibles. And all this is in the record?
Yes.
General intangibles, whatever that is.
Whatever there is, the receiver took. You have to understand here that the receiver...
Not sold as an asset.
They may have been. I was not involved from the beginning. All I know is that the receiver, who is a very competent attorney, probably does more of these than anybody else, Michael Polsky, took possession of this in November of 2008 and essentially hired a firm to manage the mill for him.
Okay. But these other properties, is it clear in the record who has them, all investment property?
It's clear in the record that none of these were specifically included in the auction procedure.
On the sale of the assets?
Correct.
All right.
Counsel, your opposing counsel cites the Linton case for the premise that essentially unless there's something egregious that the circuit court has to accept the recommendation of the receiver. I may not have gotten those words exactly right as I was taking notes. Can you respond to that argument?
I can, Your Honor. In this particular case especially, the operation of Olson's mill affected over hundreds of farmers, all of whom were sitting in the court's chambers wondering what was going to happen to their contracts, what was going to happen to their forward contracts, what was going to happen to their businesses. The state of Wisconsin was at the hearings representing the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Their concern was that there were all these bounced checks going around, and they didn't have the ability under the statute to continue licensing these warehouses so that grain could be sold. There are both federal and state requirements involving the sale of this grain, and in those instances, the judge was sitting there faced with this dilemma. I have in my possession a recommendation from the receiver to sell the assets to BNP. I now have in my possession an offer from Olson's Mill Acquisition Company to purchase the same assets at an enhanced value. And I have an offer from them to pay $10 million, not from the receivership funds, but out of their own pocket, to pay farmers and to pay bounce checks and to pay forward contracts. I think I have, and the judge was very eloquent. He says, I think under this statute, under 12801, I have the ability to do this. And I think he's right.
What is the standard, if any, that is then in our law regarding the requirement or the propriety of a judge to follow the recommendation of the receiver? In that Linton case, there was some reference to, you know, shocks the conscience of the judge.
Well, I think what shocked the conscience of the court in this case to the good was that my client was going to pay $10 million of claims that didn't come out of the receivership fund.
Let me rephrase my question. When may a court, or what standard is applied for a court to decline the recommendation of the receiver?
Well, I think if the court feels uncomfortable, for instance, in the situation where a bid may have produced a woefully inadequate price that the court, after hearing testimony, would find that is not adequate. Well, remember, 128 is an equitable statute, and it's very, very imperative that a court in this particular situation takes into account what are the rights that the creditors have and how can I best protect them under this particular statute.
I'm looking for a rule of law or standard. Is your standard thus, if the circuit court thinks another approach is more equitable, that's the standard? Or does the circuit court have to say, you know, this doesn't represent fair value, and or does the circuit court say, I'm going to approve it unless it is
so egregious, or does the circuit court say I have to approve it unless it shocks my conscience? What are the words?
That's what this court implies in the case that's been cited.
Which one of those that I just, which part of that litany did you like?
Well, I think it's inherent in the case, I can't think of it, Litton case, I believe is the name of it. Yeah, it's inherent in that case.
It's what in that case? I'm sorry.
Unfair or inadequate, so to shock the conscience,
right.
I think is the phrase.
I thought there were two things in the Litton. One, that there was an inadequate price that resulted from mistake, misapprehension, or inadvertence. So the second, it's inadequate to shock the conscience. And then the court says the decision to grant or refuse the decision to set aside a sale rests within the sound discretion of the trial court. Now, does that mean that it can only exercise its discretion on those two grounds, inadequate price or by mistake or shock the conscience?
Well, let's just take a look at the procedure that Mr. Polsky used in this case.
Counsel, I don't want to cut you off, but I do. Maybe there is no rule of law, or maybe this is the rule of law. If it's inadequate or unfair to shock the conscience, I want something that I can write down. This is the rule. What judges should.
I would suggest, Justice, that you can write this down.
Okay.
If, after due diligence by the receiver, the court is comfortable that the bid received without any competing bids is adequate in its mind to satisfy the secured party's involvement and look to the benefit of the creditors, then that is the rule. What you have here is you have a complication that was from its inception at the actual auction. My client and BNP were the two last people standing at the bidding process. I mean, we didn't come out of the woodwork here. We were involved intimately in the bidding process. And after we had a week to look at what happened in the bidding process, we decided we could present the court with a better deal. And that's exactly what the court bought. Now, can I move on just to one point I really think is important to make? Because we have secured transaction students here, I think it's a good point to make.
This is your great teaching opportunity. Right.
Take notes.
While BNP was a secured creditor of OMI, and it had a properly perfected security interest, that security interest attached to the property which was sold, but only to the extent of the value of the property. Both Section 409.615.4 and relevant case law recognize that a creditor's security interest consists of two parts. A secured creditor has a security claim only to the extent of the value of its collateral. The balance is an unsecured claim. And I would cite In Re Wright, Seventh Circuit Court, which is cited in the record, and those other cases. In this case, we had a value that the court, that counsel for the bank, and that the receiver all put on these assets. It was
$9 million. What assets are you talking about? Inventory? Talking about inventory?
Yes.
Okay. That's a secured.
Understand that the other assets that were sold were secured by Bay Lake Bank.
Right.
Okay? So that what we had in this sale was a $9 million value. Now, also, BNP still has some interest in the accounts receivable and the other assets that the receiver has under his control, of which nobody in this room knows what that is. Okay, unfortunately, we're still working on that. But those are the facts that we have to deal with here.
If I understand your argument, you're saying there's only one secured collateral that BNP has. That was subject to an asset sale, namely inventory.
Correct.
And all other secured items listed in the appendix wasn't sold.
That's correct.
So they're still out. They had at the $9 million, and I think you were driving towards this, was properly valued.
Yes.
But it's arguable that it was not valued in accordance with the statute. The statute has a technique, a method for valuation. And I don't see that that method was followed. Now, as I read your brief, and if I understand the argument you're going to make, it's that, hey, everybody agreed that it was $9 million. BNP agreed it was $9 million because its offer was $9 million, right?
Correct.
The other offer agreed it was $9 million because it said $9 million, right?
Correct.
So you're saying, okay, do you think the statute was precisely followed on valuation?
Let me tell you what the discourse was at that negotiation. The receiver said, I have valued the inventory at $9 million. Will you agree to pay me $9 million, whether there's $8 million there or whether there's $10 million there? I'll take my chances on that. And my response and that of my client was, whether it's $8 million, then we lose. If it's $10 million, you lose. But we agree on the value of $9 million. The problem with putting a value on this grain is it's coming in and out of these bins every day. I mean, they're bringing it in, they're taking it out. It's a fluid deal. And so everybody had to make their best guess on what was going on. And that's how we got where we got.
The other thing that bothered me about following the statute was that the distribution didn't follow the statute, it seemed to me.
Well, I don't think that's correct. First off, there's an argument by BNP that these farmers somehow got a preferential payment, but they didn't get the payment from the assets of the receivership. They got them from the third-party purchaser. In effect, taking away claims that might be available for general creditors. Okay? I mean, it's not like we sold the property in the receivership. The receivership got the money and then paid these farmers. It's that the receivership got the money from my client, and my client took additional money and paid the farmers. It had nothing to do with the receivership assets. And that's, you know, that's what is not clear from BNP's argument. This is money
that was used was not property of the receivership. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that the additional money that was paid to the farmers for the forward contracts and the bad checks and all that came out of my client's pocket.
And it was not property then of the debtor.
Correct.
Okay,
didn't it go through the receivership in some way?
Pardon?
Didn't it go through the receiver in some way?
No, it did not.
It was a direct kind of payment?
Yes.
So there was no court order relating to that?
No, it was part of our bid. And the court approved the bid, and they said, well, if you want to pay an extra $10 million, thank you very much. It keeps the farmers in business.
Why would your client do that if they weren't getting a business and the goodwill and the ongoing?
I mean,
why would they just decide to pay
you? I've asked them that question many times. The reason he did it was so that he could preserve the business of Olson's Mill. Because without the farmers being paid, he would have no source of grain to keep the business going, first. Secondly, if he didn't pay off the bad checks, the state was going to pull his license. So when you look at what he offered for this, he offered a total of 24 point something million dollars when you add up all the numbers. And of that 24 million, only part of it was going to pay for the assets that were being sold by the receiver.
Just to be devil's advocate here, why wouldn't that structure essentially be basically buying this ongoing business, but I'm going to call it an asset purchase. I'm just going to buy through the 128, $9 million of inventory, and I'm going to take this business, I'm going to pay off these people, they're going to do business with me, I'm going to run it as my own. Why isn't that
subverting the whole process and just kind of saying, we only want to include $9 million in here.
Well, it's
we want
not
to do the rest over here.
It's not subverting the process because the process was established by the receiver. It's no different than
I hear what you're saying, but I'm trying to figure out, in a different setting where you don't just have somebody who's willing to pay $10 million out of the goodness of their heart to keep these farmers bringing grain in, right? But you have a different one. Let's just say somebody in a 128 says, boy, I'd kind of like to take over that business, but I really don't want to pay for all the goodwill and everything else. I'll just call it an asset purchase or inventory purchase or whatever. We'll do that through the 128. Nobody is taking over this business now. I will do that outside of the 128 proceeding and basically run with it. Well, in a different setting, wouldn't that really promote the idea of undermining secured creditors?
I think if you took it out of a 128, I could argue that that's pretty common practice in the commercial world. The problem is, in a 128, a court would have to supervise that, and that's what he did in this case. He said, you know what, when I look at the big picture here, Mr. Martini might be nuts for putting an extra $10 million into this business, but it's $10 million that's going to keep the thing running for now, and good for him if he can make it going. Your question, I think, would be in a case where there wasn't a 128, and let's say you had a distressed business, and there were vultures hanging around trying to buy it. There's a lot of times when a bidding for a business in an unsupervised forum will create situations where people try to get the best advantage for what they're buying. And that's just the nature of the beast. Every business has accounts receivable, it has inventory, it has customers, and without customers, no business can work. That's pretty obvious. And in this case, Mr. Martini wanted to make sure that the customers were taken care of.
But part of the purpose of a 128 is to make sure secured creditors are covered first, and then you go down the line.
And to give them the right to participate.
Right.
Sorry, my time is up.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Williamson.
Let me begin where my colleague ended. The contention that the successful bidder took money out of his own pocket to pay farmers for their grain misses the point. It was that fact that led the trial court to say, gee, this is a better offer. So the fact that it didn't come out of proceeds or that it came from the purchaser, not through the receiver, it's simply not relevant because it led the trial court to say, I picked this proposal over BNP's proposal.
Counselor, isn't it that same payment that you were saying was a distribution from the receivership that didn't include your client in any way? I mean, wasn't that one of your arguments that other unsecured creditors got paid and your client didn't? And wasn't it the same payments we're talking about here?
That's correct, Your Honor, but there were additional payments to other unsecured creditors in which BNP, for its deficiency claim, never shared. Now,
I have difficulty with that.
Right, me too.
They sold assets. One asset was the inventory, right?
Yes.
And the other assets belonged to another secured creditor, right?
Yes, although my client had a second lien on them as well.
Okay. What other assets were sold? I suggest none.
and that the buyer, the assets 6.5 for all owned equipment and real estate, Baylang Bank security interest, and the buyer assumed obligations, right? So do you consider that assumption of obligations a payment to the receiver?
I believe the trial court did, Your Honor. But here's the point, and this, I think, ultimately goes back to Justice Rogan-Sack's dissatisfaction so far on this valuation question. The assets were not valued, and the Chief Justice made a reference to the fact that this procedure did not include an appropriate valuation. That accounts in large part for the fact that my colleague and I share this uncertainty about what these things, these assets, were worth. But we know this. They were worth more than $9 million. And we know this, that BNP had a secured interest in those things, even intangible, because at the auction proceeding, the trial court said it was wanted to convey this as a going concern. The purchaser said it was buying this as a going concern. That was the whole point. And Justice Rogan-Sack, referring to the list in the appendix, the going concern value is something in which BNP had a secured interest. It was obviously worth something, somewhere between $1 and $15 million, which is the value of what OMAC, the acquiring company, paid.
Counselor, does the opposing counsel counters that argument with the going concern value was worth nothing if your clients bought it, because the related companies and the two brothers who also had given a security interest on this were not going to do business with your clients. So you couldn't sell it as a going concern unless you sold it to a buyer that they were going to work with. What do you say about that?
My response, Your Honor, is that we can't, from this distance, literal and temporal, know the answer to that. But my client obviously believed there was value in it as a going concern. Indeed, most businesses are worth more as a going concern than as a stack of furniture and computers or a silo full of grain. It was in their interest, by definition, to sell it as a going concern. The phrase has been used both from the podium and the bench of the enhanced offer that OMAC made for the entity. Let us not forget that enhanced offer included a $9 million interest-free loan. Let us not forget that enhanced offer was not the subject of due diligence. Couldn't have been. It was written out in court. The receiver conducted due diligence and concluded that BNP's bid was
also,
the one.
What rate of interest do you think is due on? The loan you're talking about is the six-month delay in payment, right?
Yes.
What rate of interest do you think is due, and what do you rely on for that?
Well, I would have to look at the commercial rate of interest in effect at the time, Your Honor, but even if we took the statutory rate of interest in this state.
What was the rate of interest on your note that underlies all this? Is that in the record?
I do not believe it is, Your Honor, although Ms. Statler may correct me here, and
okay.
If so, we'll get the right answer. But the fact is, to call it a loan is so charitable, because it was compelled. It was a loan with the gun to your head. You must let them.
I understand that. I was just trying to figure out what rate of interest you wanted and why did you choose that rate. That was all I was asking.
And this, I think, is an example of the trial court's good intentions without a shred of foundation in the law. The court said, well, look, if you had to sell the grain yourself, it would cost you something. And they're going to sell the grain for you.
So it'll work out.
Well, good faith. You know, he was trying. The judge was trying. But you can't do that with a secured obligation. You simply can't. A reference was made to the credit bid process, which is fashionable these days in federal bankruptcy law. But I would simply direct the court's attention to footnote 10 on page 30 of our brief, which provides citation for the court's unwillingness to entertain a renewed credit bid by BNP.
Go ahead.
But, and this gets us back to the real beginning. BNP had no compulsion to credit bid. BNP had no need to put in additional evidence on the value of any of the items in the 12 or 14 item laundry list, because I believe it is black letter law that without the secured creditor's consent, the security cannot be compromised or disposed of. And Justice Rogensack, the very last of these items in little I through XIV says, to the extent not otherwise included, all proceeds and products of any and all of the foregoing. And my colleague is right. Grain was coming in, grain was going out. But in effect, that was our grain. It was BNP's grain, just like the goodwill of the entity going forward. And by the way, the entity is going forward today. It has value. It's why the notion of a remand I don't find terribly daunting, because there is a proceeding, there is a company, there is an entity, and there are assets, all of which, to take the Chief's point, can be appropriately valued, and they simply weren't. Thank you for your attention.
With regard to your argument that the distribution didn't follow the statute, here they agreed, the buyer of the assets agreed to assume obligations. The buyer, and therefore paid out to farmers who are unsecured, right? So is it your argument that that's really the court paying it out?
In effect, the court made it possible, Your Honor, because it accepted the bid of OMAC relying on this extra statutory payment.
So, in effect, you're saying that the receiver would have received $9 million for inventory, $6.5 for the equipment and real estate, and I don't have the final figure, $2.7 or what it may have been $4 million by then for assuming the obligation. So it was really paying for the assets $9 plus $6 plus $4. And that the extra belonged to the secured creditors first, or at least to be divided by the secured creditors for their now loss of the security along with everybody else.
Correct, Chief Justice. And in that regard, precisely, the successful bidder, OMAC, also paid bounce checks.
Yeah, I mean, that was the added
right.
amount.
Bounce checks. Yeah. Bounce checks are a claim. Every case this court takes is important, otherwise it wouldn't take it. But in this field of commercial lending, particularly in these times, certainty, whether it's good certainty or bad certainty, is something that lenders, whether it's the local bank in Portage or a larger bank located outside of the state, need some certainty. And the Court of Appeals summary decision, precedential or not, didn't provide it. The trial court's good faith, but incorrect decisions didn't provide it, that's for sure. This court can provide it, and I think there are practical remedies that at the end of the day will provide both justice and certainty.
Counselor, I see that your red light is on, and I don't want to delay you, but I just wondered if your colleague found the rate of interest on the note at default in the record. If it's not in the record, then we're out of luck here.
One moment, Your Honor. I hope so.
Sidebar answer is?
Right.
Your Honor, we are quite confident that the answer is in record document number 2, and which is the credit agreement, and it is voluminous, as they tend to be. We certainly would be glad to provide that post-argument.
I can read it. I just want you to point me in the right direction.
I'm sure it'll make delightful reading, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Thank you, Mr. Olgenicsik, for your arguments today on Chapter 128, which you both agree doesn't come to us very often, and especially in this complex case, which is still proceeding, I gather, at the trial court level. That concludes our argument in 09-AP-1007, BNP Paribas versus Olson's Mill, Inc. The court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third oral argument today.